Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about elementals in D&D. Where do they come from? How often do they get used? Are they a good option for high-level wizards? And what the hell did they do in the new D&D Monster Manual for 2024? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the discussion on elementals, I will remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I on Discord, and all of our patrons are eligible to join in. You can join in, too, just by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join in at any tier, and you will get an invite link to our private Discord server. Get that all set up, get your account going, and get yourself logged in before the end of the hour, and maybe about 10 minutes after the show, maybe 15, depending on how quick we're moving, we will be there to host our after-party chat.
We love that part of our week. We would love to see you there. We have just such great patrons. And for example, thanks to our patron Bacrius for checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and other places right now, which is fantastic. Thank you for that. So, Paul, I was thinking about elementals because we are getting ready for a couple of conventions in the month of April. Next weekend is our house con with friends up in Massachusetts. And so I routinely now run this session that I call Wizards War Zone. Everybody gets max level wizards in original D&D. All the spells in the whole game are available. And it's mano a mano PvP, eliminate all your opponents as much as you can. And one of the top options that I have to prepare for and that is very attractive to a lot of players is the Conjure Elemental spell. So I kind of put some thought into nailing down my rulings and trying to make it clear to the players, because in the past, there's been some surprises around how elementals work in early D&D, and I continually try to clarify that, and it's one particular thing that I really have to be on the lookout for.
I love the origin story of this game, Dan. So for any viewers who maybe don't know, Dan has put together a booklet called the Book of Spells, Original Edition Delta Book of Spells, and it's just a real nice, I don't know, what would you call it, Dan? House ruling or
brief?
Reframing maybe of all of the wizard spells from original edition D&D, with a goal of like keeping everything nice and concise, just a couple of sentences, but actually explaining things as opposed to what's in the original edition of the game, where you get explanations like haste is the opposite of slow, and that's it.
If that.
So the funny thing is, I'm holding here in my hand a second edition booklet. Dan, what edition are we up to?
I have a third edition draft that we've been playing with for a little bit, which is what you'll see this weekend.
Okay, so if I reference the second edition in this show, I'm not too far off the money. Hopefully.
You're not too far off the money. You're not too far off the money.
And so the my point being that the origin of this game that Dan is running, where he's got a group of players and every one of them has one max level wizard and they just duke it out, was that like. I think you were noticing that in your own games, there was just very little testing and very little use of the top tier spells.
Yes.
And so this is an excuse to pull them out. Like, let's go.
Exactly.
Top level spells. Exactly. All top level spells. Go, go, go. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think a lot of us will say that top level, high level D&D is classically kind of broken-ish, is kind of breaks down in some ways. And I feel that it's because it wasn't really play tested as nearly as much as low-level play, and I would like to resolve that. So that's exactly what I've been doing for a while now, is finding opportunities to playtest those kinds of things. And it continues to be surprising. Players pull interesting uses out of their pocket and go, does this work? And I go, never thought of it in 40 years. Never. It never occurred to me ever.
Such a wild tangent here, Dan. But some folks may know I've recently been experimenting with running D&D games DM'd by an AI. called Martha. You can see some of those videos here on our channel, D&D with Martha, the AI DM. Just me as the only player, AI as the DM. And a couple of viewers have called out, have you tried inverting it? Have you tried running a game with the AI as the player? And I'm kind of resisted that a bit because, like, I don't think it leans into the strengths of the AI necessarily. And, like, it's the fun of it, really, for me, is the crazy inventiveness of the AI and letting it just, you know, generate new content for me that I never would have thought of. But someone pointed out, like, but it would be great for, like, playtesting your stuff, right? Would you ever, Dan, run a game of Wizards Warzone with AI players? Just for the sake of playtesting.
I will say, okay, so I have this system for many years at this point that I call Arena, that is specifically to generate statistics on things like monsters and character capacities and generate, you know, what's the equivalent of challenge ratings of monsters in original D&D. And for quite a while, you know, and at some point to begin with, it was just fighters, and then I added wizards. And of course, implementing, you know, do you implement all the spells? That's probably too much work for me. Implement some of the what seems to be canonically important attack defense spells. I did that. And then the question is, when do you use them? When's the right time to use a death spell as opposed to a fireball spell as opposed to invisibility? And I, for years, I've been saying in my, you know, so I made some high level tactical decisions around that. And for years, I've been saying in some ideal future world, there'll be an AI that I can plug into Arena to make those tactical decisions wisely. And I haven't had time to work on that recently. But honestly, Paul, that is ultimately in some ideal point, that's actually my end game.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I think the tools are there at this point, right? You could probably start making some API calls to Anthropic or OpenAI or something to make those choices for you. Not free, though. Not free, so
understood. Yes,
yeah.
Understood. I think we're anyway. Getting, yeah, I agree that I kind of want to be able to do that plugin. Are we? Yeah.
Are we? I don't know. Elementals. We're supposed to be talking about elementals, right?
Right. Elementals. When do you use elementals? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So the amusing thing is, I have this in my hand because, of course, I was looking at the Conjure Elemental. Right. That's kind of the origin of some of this discussion. And so I was looking at it in some editions, and I was like, well, let me see what Dan actually wrote. Maybe I can pose some questions to Dan about, like, why did you come up with this choice? So there you go. Be prepared, Dan. I'm ready. I'm ready this time. Please.
Well, shoot. Yeah. Let me just grab my, I actually didn't grab my copy of that right in front of me. Okay. So I have, I also have the second edition in front of me. And I will say that one thing that has bothered, and Backweez and some of our other patrons will point this out, is that there's always footnotes. So I have the brief player-facing spell, and then there's some footnotes that may or may not come into play based on the DM preferences, and some people have given me grief about that. So don't overlook the footnote.
Okay. Okay. Well, my printing doesn't have footnotes, Dan. How could I possibly follow them?
No, is that here. Is that like, oh, because I've added them in the third edition. That's why. Oh my God. The second edition didn't have footnotes. Holy smoke. To be clear, the third edition, when it comes out, will be mostly footnotes. The majority of the page count is the footnotes, not the spells.
That is delightful. It's starting to be like, I don't know, I was a English major in college, and I have plenty of those books of like classic classic pieces of literature from history, from English literature, but printed for an academic setting. And like most of those books, like they're half of them are footnotes and commentary and whatnot. And the actual text of the original novel you're trying to read is maybe a third to a half of the page count. So well done, Dan. You've been in academia too long, I think.
But to be clear, right, the footnotes are fun to, I mean, some other people get used to them, but to me, they're like, Dan, you've done this research before. Don't do it again. Largely, that's when you see a footnote, it's like, I've done this research at least twice and I need to stop.
That's hilarious. All right. So let's get into the history of elementals a little bit, and then I'm sure that will lead us in the direction of talking about some of the rules and rulings around these spells and around their stats and etc.
Yeah.
Where'd that come from?
Don't worry, everyone. The intervention will be live streamed.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Yes, I know you care about it.
Yeah. All right. So you've done probably way more research than I have on this, Dan. Where do you want to start in terms of the history here?
Well, I feel like, okay, so, you know, the first thing is, like, where is the whole idea of conjuring elementals come in the first place? And I feel that for brand new players of D&D, again, you know, they're much more defensive about IP. They're much more defensive about, you know, one of my irritations, frankly, with current D&D is that it wants to be entirely self-encapsulated and self-referential, and D&D just talks about D&D. And again, at the outset, D&D was talking about other things, and it had lots and lots of connections directly to other literature. So it might go unnoticed by some folks that probably the biggest inspiration for D&D elementals comes directly from Michael Moorcock's Elric books. And it's throughout many of the Elric books, it's a very fundamental issue that Elric and his people have pacts with specifically the elemental lords, and in different adventures or different novels, he will call upon the aid of the elemental lord that's particularly useful. So there's one that I particularly like, a scene that happens in The Bane of the Black Sword, and I have that. I kind of want to read that because just I kind of want to touch back to the Moorcock literature that inspires a lot of D&D. So that's the one with the red dot on it.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Story time from Dan.
Story time.
Tell us a story, Dan.
near the start of chapter 4 here, it says, Philip Cairna had respect born of fear for the powers of the Aeromancer, the rare wizard who can control the wind elementals. The Aeromancy was only one of the arts which Elric and his ancestors possessed. Then Philip Cairna realized what he was battling 10,000 years and hundreds of generations of sorcerers who had gleaned knowledge from the earth and beyond it and passed it down to the albino who he, Philip Cairna, had sought to destroy. Then Philip Cairna fully regretted his actions, but it was too late. The sorcerer had no control over the powerful wind giants, which is what they're calling elementals here, as Elric had. His only hope was to combat one element with another. The fire spirits must be summoned, and quickly. All of Philip Cairna's pyromantic powers would be required to hold off the ravening supernatural winds, which were soon to shake the air and the earth. Even hell would shake to the sound and the thunder of the wind giant's wrath. Quickly, Philip Cairna marshaled his thoughts and with trembling hands began to make strange passes in the air and promise unhealthy pacts with whichever of the powerful fire elementals would help him this once. He promised himself to eternal death for the sake of a few more years of life. With the gathering of the wind giants came the thunder and the rain. The lightning flashed sporadically, but not lethally. It never touched the earth. Elric, Moonglum, and the men of Imrir were aware of disturbing movements in the atmosphere, but only Elric, with his witch sight, could see a little of what was happening. The Lashar giants were invisible to other eyes. And so that leads to a massive battle around a castle between the air elementals that Elric has on his side and the fire elementals that are trying to defend the castle there. And so a couple of things there is they obviously, you know, we can call them air elementals and fire elementals. Those are directly used in the text. They have other names, like the air elementals are wind giants or Lashar, and the fire elementals have some other names on their own that they might use, which is great. Notice that the air elementals there are associated with storms and lightning. They're shooting out lightning, which is not something you get in D&D, which is fine. The battle winds up, you wind up having the elementals battling in the air over the castle, separate from the mortal men invading, storming the castle in these basically separate engagements that mirror each other. And I think you get a lot of that kind of action in classic D&D of a mass battle. It really winds up being separate between your high level whatever's in a duel and the normal men having a mass battle as these separate engagements is kind of this beat that you get over and over again. And then finally, it ends with the two lords on either side, the lord of the air elementals, Misha, directly dueling the lord of the fire elementals, Kakatal, over the castle, as Elric finally confronts Thaleb Kayarna in the climactic duel at the end. So kind of interesting, and kind of a beat, in addition to just like there are elementals that people use like this, it also kind of echoes a lot of the sensibility of how do mass battles work, what's storming a castle like in D&D, and a lot of what Gygax and Arneson really comes out of that.
It's really fascinating, I think, because like the very idea of the four elements, right, and they're being contrary to each other, and magic drawn from those that battle each other, the ideas of like entities composed entirely of that element that maybe possibly live in another plane of existence that can be summoned forth by powerful wizards, like all of these feel like such strong fantasy tropes, and I also like tried to dig up like where did these come from, what is the like literary source of this concept, and frankly Moorcock is the only thing I could find. Yeah. I completely agree here with you, Dan. I think like that's got to be the influence, and I find it bleeds into the rules in such interesting places. My favorite one, I was digging through the first edition AD&D Monster Manual, and the bottom section of each entry has this very nebulous statement, right? So there's this thing, like, I'll just read the air elemental one, which says, mm-hmm. The very last, there's one final paragraph that just says, on the elemental plane of air can be found certain intelligent air elementals which have special abilities beyond the above. Some are stronger than the most powerful of conjured elementals. Their queen is both powerful and has certain magical abilities.
Right.
Certain
right.
magical abilities. What the hell
right.
does that mean?
I agree. I'm so glad you pulled that out, Pope, because I also, when I read that as a kid originally, I mean, it's just this really inspiring, you know, vague, like there's more to learn, but we're not going to tell you today. And that is just like crack. That is just like crack to the personality, right? In the right age, the right mindset to light D&D, or for the earth elemental, there's a line that just says, the last line just says, on the elemental plane of earth, there exists a boss rumored to be of astounding size.
Yeah, so good. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And so the DM could fill it in, or I'm like, is there, where can I learn more?
And it's so interesting, right? Because I think also here, it might be in the same DMG here where, I think it describes elementals as being, quote, I wrote it down. it describes them as being, quote, stupid and resent being summoned, right? Elementals are stupid and resent being summoned. So, okay, they're kind of like that in my brain, because I think because they're weird, like spirits or something, and they're composed entirely one element, that they're maybe kind of undead-like in their automatous-like reactions or behaviors. But then you get these things, right? And the fire elemental one says that the ruler of all fire elementals is reported to be known as the tyrant. Okay, so clearly there's these much smarter, much more intelligent creatures on the elemental planes. And yeah, it's very strange and interesting, and clearly must be drawing inspiration from that story you just read for us and other of Moorcock's work. Because again, I cannot find, there's certainly other instances in pulp fiction of pulp fantasy authors of talking about other planes of existence or summoning creatures from beyond, but elementalism or elementals and the elemental planes, can't find it anywhere.
I agree with that. It's a very narrow type of literature. You kind of have to go back to Moorcock. Yeah. Some people could possibly go back to some stuff in medieval mythology, things like sprites, like Ariel in Shakespeare, maybe, but that's quite a bit of more of a stretch. And obviously the D&D elementals are obviously inspired by Moorcock. And I'll say this, look, I'm intrigued by like, what, tell me more about the bosses. I want to find out more about this. And fortunately, they did scratch our itch a couple years later when they came out with, and actually you could pull up the image with the green dot, actually, Paul. So if you look in the, I believe, 1980 Deities and Demigods, there's a section on the Myths of Elric from Moorcock. And we actually get stat blocks for each of those bosses, as a matter of fact. So here's the one for Earth Elementals. The Earth Elemental of astounding size. This is it. Specifically, it's Grom from the Moorcock books. He's 20 feet tall. He counts as a lesser god. He has over 300 hit points. And he is the king of the Earth Elementals. So you can canonically, in first edition, go into the Deities and Demigods book and find exactly what they're talking about if you don't want to make it up yourself. But I like the fact, again, you know, nowadays they probably wouldn't just, you know, pick something out of another literature, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're much more defensive about IP purposes. But I love the fact that the first edition Monster Manual was cryptically talking about Moorcock. It's right in there. And when push comes to shove, that's what they detail. We've had the good fortune of having Michael Moorcock on the show last season. And I don't think I got an opportunity to ask him about what the relationship was to get this material in Deities and Demigods. If we have him on again, I guess I should ask his perspective on that, actually. But I love the fact that they have this in actual core books in first edition.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. I do feel like the elements, right, the elemental planes, elemental magic, etc., is something that over time TSR and later Wizards continue to like add on and add on and add on to, right? Like you start, like I feel like every monster book, every monster manual or monster's compendium, etc., added in a few, let's put in a few more elemental creatures, right? Yep. And here's a funny bit of Wandering DM's history for you viewers. In our first game ever that Dan and I played of D&D, when we first met and we first started playing AD&D, my character was playing an Earth Elementalist from the second edition Tome of Magic.
Right.
You remember that book.
Right.
Yeah, most folks will remember this book as being the introduction to meta magic and specifically wild magic, introduced the concept of wild magic, which I think a lot of people maybe resented the crazy monkey wrench that it threw into their games. I certainly played with it a little bit and was like, this is just too much. But the elementals in, you know, so the Tome of Magic, in addition to having like a whole bunch of extra spells for all of the spellcasting classes, had two new classes: the wild magician. What did they call him?
Wild mage.
Yeah, and the elemental mage, right? And so they had options for playing, and it wasn't that much to them. Frankly, it was like, oh, you get a couple bonuses when you use.
Yeah.
Spells that are of an element, and you get to memorize one extra spell per level as long as it is in one of these little lists of elemental magic. They tried to add some extra elemental spells, some of which are quite weird. The one that always made me really wonder is the fourth level wizard spell Pebble to Stone or Pebble to Boulder. I don't know if you remember this one, really? Dan. But it's very strange. It's a fourth level wizard spell. You cast it on a pebble and you throw the pebble and it turns into a giant boulder, right? And so you get an attack roll. Right. And it does, right? It's neat. It's evocative, right? It's a nice piece of magic. Yeah. It's a good earth elemental spell. So fourth level spell, Dan. Give me your best guess here. How many pebbles do I get and how much damage do they cause?
Okay, so we always have a problem because fireball at third level is so massively useful all the time and comparably does a lot of damage. In theory, if you were to balance it with that, I feel like you want to get at least your levels worth of damage. So I would say like at least 8 or 10 or more dice of damage total, I would think.
Yeah, that's what you would think. You get at seventh level when you can first get this spell for the first time ever, and I'm prevaricating here a little bit so I can scroll to it and not misquote it. you get one pebble. You get exactly one to start with at seventh level, and it does. Where is it? Come on, I believe it does something like 3d6 plus 8 damage.
Sort of like 5 dice, sort of. Yeah.
I couldn't find it because it's called turn pebble to boulder called. 3d6 plus 8 points of damage, and then you start to get additional pebbles as you level up. one stone at 7th level. You get 2 at 10th, 3 at 13th. It's pretty underwhelming, frankly.
Yeah.
Compared to why would I waste a 4th level spell slot on this instead of say Ice Storm and do, you know, 8d6 damage. 3d6 plus 8.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that's my gripe. That's my gripe about that spell. Anyway. So there you go. Yeah, I played an elementalist, you know, who had a knack for seemed to like to eat dirt on occasion. Made himself some mud pies now and again. It was a lot of fun.
I like the spell that turned his fists into stone, if I recall correctly. Yeah,
that's the first level. That is the first level earth magic spell they give you on the list, which turned your fist into stone. Let you make a single attack. Or at least, I think it lasted a round and you could swing punches with it and it had 18 double zero strength. I was like, that's clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a fun character because I made him kind of big and strong and dumb, which was just weird.
Yeah. Wizard. Kind of like an elemental, actually. Kind of like an elemental themselves, right? And I can see the awkward design issue because I've tried the same kind of thing myself. And part of the problem, you know, I want aeromancers like Moorcock's talking about. And, you know, partly, you know, the core doesn't have these different channels for wizards that you talk about in literature a lot. And the other thing is, all obviously, you're really aiming in the directions I want that conjure elemental spell. It's almost a top level spell. It's 5th out of the 6 levels in original D&D. And it's like, what do you put in for filler until I get to that canonical spell nearly at the end of the chain? And it does wind up being a little bit awkward like that.
Yeah. Sadly, I think these spells, it's easy to accidentally kind of video gamify this stuff and just be like, okay, well, we'll have a 1st level spell that shoots a magical bolt for 1d6 damage and you can decide which element it is. Like, does it matter then if I'm throwing rocks or fire or air?
I agree with that.
The air will you kind of want the spells to each have their own flavor a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. I want the earth to fundamentally make a difference versus fire versus water. I don't just want it to be a label that keys into some monster's label. There should be, you can't use fireball underwater. Great. And I believe that that's not a thing in current modern D&D, if I recall correctly. They're like, well, we didn't put it in the spell, so that's not part of how it works.
That's fine. I do feel like the older editions of the game, they tried to play with these sort of damage types, but they didn't quite close the circle, right? But there was this idea, right, of like, you kind of have fire damage, lightning damage.
Mm-hmm.
Acid
and cold is in original D&D. You have fire, cold, lightning, and acid. And frankly, at the outset, it didn't even have that. Really, if you go all the way back to chainmail, it's great because we see that in the Moorcock text, is there's just two. There's fire and there's lightning. And your chainmail wizards, every round, can cast, you pick one. They're either a fire wizard or they're a lightning wizard. They're either associated with fire or air elementals fundamentally.
Yep.
And then it's a little bit awkward as they bring in slightly different types. It wasn't really designed around that in the first place. And it's always been a little bit of an awkward fit.
Which feels right out of that chunk of text you read to us, right?
Totally.
Like, there you go. Fire and lightning. The end.
That's exactly it.
And those have become the
first two dragon types, red and blue. Your dragons are either shooting fire or lightning, and then they added more after that.
Fascinating.
Totally.
So shall we dig into the one elemental spell that does exist across all the editions of Conjure Elemental? Or do you want to talk more about some of the origins?
I want to look at it in to begin with the chainmail to begin with, because which I have the text with the orange, must be the orange text, and a couple spots of highlighting. So conjuration of an elemental here has been part of the game since years before D&D. So the very first printing of chainmail in 1971 had the fantasy supplement back, had dragons and wizards and things like that. Only had 6 spells. Only 6 spells in the game at the outset. And number 6, the last one, the most powerful spell in the game, was Conjuration of an Elemental. It has been here since forever. And so if you look at the controlling text here, a lot of the restrictions, limitations, jagged edges, you know, again, kind of looking back at Moorcock, have been here since the beginning. And so if I read, so, you know, part of the awkwardness of Conjure Elemental since forever is there's going to be some page flipping, is you have the spell description and then you have the monster description, and they're probably in two different books, probably printed at different times. They might possibly be out of sync with the restrictions that they're talking about. I guess in programming, we call that the don't repeat yourself principle, because you're always going to wind up with this problem when you do that. So in Chainmail, the spell at the top here says, wizards can conjure elementals, but no more than one of each type can be brought into existence. If the wizard who conjured the elemental is disturbed, attacked, while the elemental is still in existence, he loses control of it, and it will then attack the conjurer. And of course, those are, as far as the second one, probably a lot of us are familiar with. It's the first example of concentration in the game. Obviously, in fifth edition, I'm always rattled when I play fifth edition, because they use concentration, and what seems to me like half of all the spells have this concentration limitation. At the outset, there's just one, and boy, is it a doozy. It's just for Conjure Elemental. You have to concentrate on the elemental, and if you look in other rules, that's very restrictive. You can't move. You can't cast any other spells. You can't take any actions. You can't attack. You cannot. You just get attacked. You just get attacked.
Yeah.
It's gone, right? And it turns and attacks you. That's a big problem with your elementals, and that has been there since, you know, day one there. And then it basically repeats it again at the bottom of the monster section, the bottom what we're looking at there.
I find that really very interesting, right? That the concentration is fascinating, but before we get into the concentration, I want to talk about like that you can only have one of any type, because I saw this language again and again and again in the different texts.
Yeah.
And often it was in the realm of, you can only conjure one elemental per type per day, regardless of source, right? And I saw this throughout the editions, right? If you have a magic staff and a magic wand and a spell and a dozen other things that conjure elementals, you're still limited to one fire elemental per day. The end. You cannot have a second fire elemental until tomorrow. I guess you could go conjure a different one, like an air or whatnot. You know, the one case, and here we go. Here's my push. The one case where I saw this this countered is this booklet, the Book of Spells.
Yep.
See, why did you change it, Dan? Why did you change it? Dan says that you can only one conjuration can be made per day from any given elemental body, hill, river, etc. Which I get the logic of that, right? Like, okay, yeah, so a giant chunk of this hill just came out as an earth elemental. There's probably not enough in there anymore for another one. But presumably I could go target a different
take. That is not what I was thinking, but it's an interesting
take. That's not what you're going for. Okay.
It's not what I was going for. My background thinking was like a particular hill has an elemental spirit. Like any particular feature has one elemental spirit that you draw forth, and that's been used up for the day, was what I was kind of thinking about. So that language, which again in Chainmail just says there can only be one of each type, period, that's not even limiting it to a particular caster. That evolves through the editions, like you're saying, Paul. Then it becomes like one per caster, it becomes one per day, it becomes one per casting of the spell. And that's probably a little different in every single edition of D&D all along. So me trying to find some kind of, like, why are we even saying this? Like, what is the point of this? And trying to find a middle ground was, you can get one from any particular feature that you're summoning it from. Just to kind of rationalize that. Now, that's the thing that has been most surprising to players that sit down at Wizards Warzone. I've had some players really trip up over that, of one player casts whatever fire elemental, and this, right after that, the second player tries to do the same thing, and I say, no, according to this rule, the fire elemental from this particular lava river has been consumed and you can't get another one. And I have had some people be pretty upset with me that that was a surprise. So that's very much on my mind there.
I mean, it seems to me that anyone packing conjure elemental should certainly have on their person a torch, a water skin, a bag of sand, and a balloon. I don't know.
for me, it has to be much larger than that. For me, you can't just be. It's way too. You need way more than you can carry around. So it's got to be like a mountain or the sky or the Mississippi River or something. Fair, maybe not quite that big, but something
that
fairly
really
big in the terrain.
Limit fire elementals then, though, right? Because you got to basically set a house on fire to get one of them.
That is exactly correct. And I was looking at my language in Book of War, and that's exactly what it says. You need something, you need at least a house, if not a forest fire going, in order to get a fire elemental. Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's a big divergence, I feel like, from the source.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's close in some editions. Let me just look in first edition, because now in first edition, you need a material component, which is very similar to what you just said, Paul, almost identically.
Yeah. And it does seem like you're much more likely going to see earth and air elementals, right? Because certainly there's the ground, there's the sky.
Agreed.
Yeah, I could probably pull out those elementals. Maybe if I'm near an ocean or a river or a lake, I can get a water elemental, maybe.
And admittedly, you know, the water elementals say they can only function in water. So that's the only places you can use them. So in addition to the material components, kind of like what you're thinking about, Paul, the first edition text for the spell does say a considerable fire source must be in range to conjure an elemental of that type. A large amount of water must be likewise available for conjuration of a water elemental. So I think that was where I was originally inspired by kind of working that in, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It does certainly makes the fire elementals more rare, which is, I don't know.
And I say, if you're in a dungeon and the you have a roof over your head, you can't conjure an air elemental in that case in my games.
Okay.
Just to try to make that parallel. Yeah.
Suck the air right out of the dungeon. Everyone suffocates.
Well, I the spirit of the sky is not available. But you're the DM. You can interpret it how you want. but I was kind That's of riffing funny. Off that first edition text there. You need a large that amount is, of it. Yeah,
that is interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about the concentration thing. So I totally agree that concentration like became a big deal in fifth edition, right? And we didn't see it before, and this is clearly the birthplace of it. We certainly see it all over. I noticed that, where do you land on that with yours? Do you feel like you're being generous or not with what you do or don't allow people to do at this point once they're concentrating on their elemental?
I'm a little generous. I think sometime in first edition or second edition, they start letting your wizard like move at half speed, and I permit that. Original D&D, you'd have to be like locked in place without moving. So I do allow my wizards to move at half speed, and I feel that that's a little generous compared to where I'm coming from. It's a big limitation. It is a big limitation, and I have, as DM, I've run into this of like, oh, I'm going to get you now. My wizard casts, you know, conjure elemental, haha, and I'm like, I can't do anything anymore. I better be in a good place, and I better have some guards, because now I can't do anything with that wizard anymore as long as the elemental's on the table. And I myself have like backed myself into a corner with that.
Yeah. I don't hate that. I mean, you know, in terms of like table play, presumably if your DM is cool with it, you get to control this elemental now, which is fun, right? I'm going to go rampage around and control this crazy elemental. And then, of course, you inevitably get the gameplay of, okay, clearly the way to deal with the elemental is to go knock that guy on the head, right? Like just a nice quick slingstone to the head should not only disrupt the elemental, but now it's going to go attack you, right? Because as AD&D told us, they are stupid and resent being summoned,
right.
So here's an interesting thing I noticed there's a variation from one edition to the other about, can you intentionally get rid of the elemental? You're sitting there, you're concentrating on it, it's here. Can you be like, no, I'm done, go home?
Varies by edition, right? That's one of those things. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, sometimes doesn't say. Didn't say in original D&D. There's editions that say you have to use your own dispel magic spell to get rid of it.
That is interesting. I know BX says you can just command it to return home and off it goes.
Yeah. A reasonable ruling. I believe that they invented that. I believe that was the first time you ever see that. And feels reasonable, but I don't think anything prior to Moldvay said that. Does first edition say you have to use a dispel, I think?
I mean, dismissing it by dispel magic, which I think is what's in your edition, Dan, is fascinating to me, because obviously you must break concentration to cast that dispel magic. So you better hope that you've got around before it gets
okay.
to you.
Now, true. Now, one thing I will point out among, I don't know, one of the things that I noticed at some point is that, so that sound, you know, losing control of the elemental, it's terrible. On the other hand, you know, the first level spell protection from evil will automatically ward you from it. So elementals count as a, whatever the phrasing is, supernatural creature. I'm just looking at original D&D right now. And so if you cast, and there's other places that kind of confirm that protection from evil, but, enchanted monsters, that's the phrase. Protection from evil keeps out attacks from enchanted monsters, and you can see in other places elementals count for that. So if you're really smart, if you're really tactically smart wizard, you really ought to cast protection from evil on yourself first before you cast conjure elemental, and then you're at least immune from attacks from your own elemental.
Do you see this in Wizards Warzone? Do you basically say, is Conjure Elemental basically useless because everyone's packing a protection from evil?
I don't think I've seen anybody do that yet. I keep waiting. I keep waiting for someone to notice that, and I don't think anybody's done it yet. So there's quite a few elementals that usually come out on round one or two, and then on round three, there's usually an, oh no, is that how it works? That could be... That could be either the need for concentration, the fact that I can't cast any more, that concentration means I can't cast any more spells, the fact that if somebody hits me, it's gonna come after me. There's usually like a ha, and then oh no, like around rounds two or three.
That's funny.
Yeah.
All right. Well. I'm fascinated.
Let me point out a couple other things. Okay, so pros about elementals in classic D&D. Okay, they have the highest hit dice of any monster. So if you look in original D&D or first edition, the first thing that hits you is this is actually the highest hit dice monster in the entire game. They have, you conjure elemental gets you 16 hit die elemental, and that's bigger than any giant. It's bigger than any dragon. The Balrog itself only has 10 hit dice in original D&D. That's monumental. And then they're also only hit by magic items. Okay. And then in the Greyhawk supplement, that gets boosted to, you need a +2 magic item to hit it. There's no other monster in the game at that time that has that kind of crazy defense. So it's entirely immune to almost any normal thing attacking it. Which seems excellent saving throws, right? The maximum best saving throws. Almost no spell will affect it because of that, basically. So that all looks great. And then the downsides are the summoning one per day that's in the book there, the concentration, warded by protection from evil. It's vulnerable to other attack spells. They don't have any resistances to other attack spells, frankly. None of them have ranged attacks. So Moorcock has your air elemental shooting lightning, but none of the classic D&D elementals have any ranged attacks. It's a high-level spell. You're fighting a flyer. That flyer cannot be hit by an earth, fire, or water elemental at all. And then they also have really low damage output. In original D&D, they have very surprisingly low damage output. The earth elemental does 3d6. The fire and water do 2 dice, and the air elemental only does 1 die of damage, 1d6. So I've had people summon air elementals, 16 hit dice, an enormous number of hit points, aha, this roaring giant thing comes down, hits an opponent, and then does you get one die of damage, and there's very much a double take about how little damage it's doing. If I scale it to Book of War, the air elemental can't do any effect. That's actually below. That's too small to make any effect in a mass war situation. So you get this really weird situation of these elementals are entirely immune to most anything a standard army can throw at it, and then like the air elemental actually can't do any damage in return in the first place, and they do very little attacks in return. So swingy bag.
How do you deal with the fact that the air elemental is able to, quote, sweep away 1 and 2 hit die creatures? I found that one of the most interesting bits of text there of the elemental. Like, there's no indication of what happens to these creatures. Like, what? They're swept away.
I'm so glad you asked about that. The air elemental whirlwind ability in clearly classic D&D. I have a whole blog article trying to decode that, Paul. And I have a link in the description. I encourage you. There's a bunch of graphs. There's a bunch of pictorial graphs. It's not just text, just to be clear. You ought, as DM, if you're bringing an air elemental into the system, you ought to make a decision about what that whirlwind ability is doing. Because now my take, and I think it probably says it in the monster manual, is that those low hit die, like the first edition, those low hit die targets are just terminated. Air elemental, a full strength air elemental whirlwind sweeps away and kills all creatures of low hit die values. So I'm assuming that that's what original D&D means. But the problem becomes, how often can it do that? How many things does it affect? Do they get a saving throw? That's not stated. And so on the one hand, like I was looking at this for Book of War specifically, if you use the numbers completely as written and nobody gets a save and the air elemental is confronting an arbitrarily sized opponent, they can wipe out 400 men per round is the way the math works. 400 men. Normal men are just automatically terminated per round. And that's like two orders of magnitude higher than any weapon of mass destruction in D&D. It's insane.
Quite the variance here. The air elemental is either the worst damaging opponent or the most damaging opponent.
Exactly.
Hard to say.
Exactly. Depending on, and if the DM's walking into that and gets surprised by their ruling, you're going to get one of two very different results. So for me at the moment, I assume that they can only do that once per turn, which is once per minute. And then I also apply the air maneuvering restrictions pretty strictly in original D&D in order to cut that number down to like maybe 50 men as a result. You can see we've had at least one or two episodes of Book of War where our good friend Dan Cullinan whipped out an air elemental against me. So I was personally subject to my own rules in that. And I was trying to find kind of a middle ground. It does something pretty interesting once in a while. It's not zero, it's not infinity. And that's where I tried to tune it for Book of War. It's a really good question.
You know, my entry point is almost always BX. And of course, the BX rules usually are much more concise. And in this case, I find them really odd and nebulous, right? Because it just says they appear as great whirlwinds. It talks about the size of them. And then it says the whirlwind will catch up and sweep away creatures of less than 2 hit dice unless a saving throw versus death ray is made.
Yeah,
that's it. That's all the text you get. And it almost sounds just like anything that gets in its path is just gone. And it doesn't say killed. Right, you do get a saving throw, but swept away to I don't know where, somewhere else, doesn't matter. We're not going to talk about that anymore. I find delightful. Other interesting thing about the BX difference is that BX gives damage by size rather than type. Right, so you talked about different dice of damage based on whether it was earth, fire, water, or air. BX doesn't do that. BX actually says whether it's an 8. What is it? The different hit dice, 8, 12, 8, and 12 16?
Or 16. Yeah.
Yeah, it uses that to dictate the damage of the elemental, either 1d6, 2d6, or 3d6, which is an interesting.
I mean, reasonable-ish. I can see that. It wipes out the difference between air and earth. You know, air, very fast, right? Very fast and getting where you want, do a little bit of damage. Earth, very slow, takes a while to get to you. Then it packs an enormous wallop.
It's hard for me to say whether or not I do or don't like that, right? It levels the playing field a little bit, which is good. You don't want a crazy outlier. On the other hand, I do like the idea of each elemental having a little bit of its own flavor, right? I don't mind they're like, maybe air is more useful in this and earth's more useful in that. Dan, we're getting so close to running out of time. The one thing I want to make sure we talked about, though, was that one of the things that I found strangely consistent between the rules is that there are these three different sizes, right, based on hit dice. 8 hit die, 12 hit die, 16 hit die. And the major thing that dictates what size it is the origin, whether it is a spell, a staff, or other mm-hmm. magic summoning device, mm-hmm. right? And I find that absolutely fascinating. Where are these staves? I was looking through my OD&D book, which specifically talks about that, and I can find the magic item, and maybe I'm just not looking at the right place, but I can find the thing where it talks about elemental summoning device, right? There's a special one for each of the four elements, right? There's like a brazier that summons a fire elemental, etc., etc.
Staff of Wizardry.
Staff of Wizardry. Okay, so it's, gotcha. So it's one of the bazillion things a Staff of Wizardry mm-hmm. can do. Conjure an elemental, but a weaker elemental than all other sources? What the hell is going on? Right? Where's this come from?
My instinct would have been the reverse. It seems surprising that the raw conjure elemental, which is available to any wizard at the level, is the best thing, and then your Staff of Wizardry is the worst thing. I agree. It's unintuitive. I don't know where that came from. Yeah, I guess it's like high risk, high reward, buddy. I think with the Staff of Wizardry, you don't have to worry about the control issue, I think. And with the Conjure Elemental spell, it's there's no safety net. So yeah. I don't know. I agree. It's odd, right?
It is. It's odd. And like, why? Why even bother? Why are there three different sizes of elemental? Why? Why do we need three sizes, Dan?
I don't know.
It is awesome, right?
That's a mystery for the ages.
Do you rule in your own games? Do I still need the ruling of what kind of source of the material, right? Hill or river, etc. Is that the same regardless of size and device used to conjure them?
Never, you know, honestly, Paul, never came up. John in the chat here is asking how often do elementals come up, and they come up quite a bit for me the way I run my games. But they're almost always because wizards are casting conjure elemental spells. Yeah. So
it's interesting because the evocative image that comes for me every time I think of that brazier of fire elemental summoning is that the fire elemental comes out of the brazier. Surely it's a source of fire, right? Surely the elemental comes out of that thing.
Great.
Or is it just something that I have to set up in front of me and ceremoniously light on fire, and that somehow creates a link between me and the elemental fire spirit? Maybe. I don't know.
Up to you as DM on that one, I think. That's open to interpretation.
That is interesting.
I gotta mention one thing here, Paul. We'll do it very briefly because I said it at the opening, and I'm going to feel guilty if I don't mention this. So we've recently had the 2024 Monster Manual for the current D&D come out, and I saw Jeremy Crawford talking about some changes they made to elementals. And of course, now since third edition, you have a whole lot of other stuff that have the tag elemental. So of course, salamanders and other invisible stalkers and other things are like are in the elemental category. And they thought that it would be a good idea to have what I would call a racial type, and of course they're calling a folk, that's that counts as an elemental. And since first edition, there have been these Azure creatures that are canonically from the fire elemental plane, and they were like, oh, in order to balance it out, in order to have it be equitable, we're going to pick a pre-existing race of different types and change the category from humanoid to elemental. And so they said the Aarakocra creatures are now air elementals, and merfolk now count as elementals, when initially, like in original D&D, they were a subtype of men. They were actually a subtype of humans in all ways, interestingly enough. And then we got to pick some very well-known common D&D monster that we're going to tag as the Earth type. Can you or anyone else guess what they picked to change from humanoid to elemental for earth type specifically.
For earth, I don't know, goblin.
Maybe interesting guess, not super far off.
Because they live underground, I was thinking. Yeah, no, kobolds.
Yeah, right. Right, kobolds, right? Greek, German mythology in mines. That would be more reasonable than what they did. Here's the answer. They picked lizard folk.
Really?
They picked lizard folk that live underwater, can breathe underwater, have a great swimming skill, all this kind of thing. And they said lizard folk are earth elementals.
Really? That is an odd choice.
Yeah.
What an odd choice,
right? And I feel my takeaway is I feel that's the downfall you get when you over-systemize things. And that feels very similar to like August Derleth going back to Lovecraft, chaos monsters, and saying, oh, Cthulhu is a water monster and Hestor is an air monster and there's a fire monster and there's something else. I don't think it's not the best design. I'm going to have four things, I guess, but you back yourself into these like, it really didn't have that at the outset, and I don't think that was a great idea. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
That seems an odd choice. And
right?
I don't know. Okay. I can complain about a dozen parts of this, but I'm not sure there's a reason to. That's weird. That's weird.
Right? I thought so.
We are definitely out of time. Any final thoughts on elementals?
I'm so glad elementals are in the game, frankly. For me, it's a really interesting place that keeps coming up in my games. It's risky, it's dangerous, it's exciting. I'm glad, I think that it's a good idea to be inspired by someone's actually inspired literature like Michael Moorcock's. I think that's part of the reason why it has legs, frankly. And it's one of those weird things. I think if you were making pure game mechanics, you would come up with something very different. It looked very different in third edition, things like that. But I like these kind of jagged edges that resemble literature that are kind of high risk, high reward. And I like the continuing challenge of DMing elementals, frankly, and I really like that they're in the game.
Yeah. I think they're great. I almost feel bad that so much has been systemized out of them, right? Whether you're talking about the elemental tag or the concept of concentration, I don't mind that elemental, conjuring an elemental is the one and only thing that has this weird concentration mechanism to it. It's kind of cool and fun. I don't know. I'm into it.
I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, so I guess I kind of like that. I almost want to simplify them even more. Like, why are there three sizes? I don't need three sizes. Just make one elemental. Like, the end.
I don't deal with the other two sizes. So frankly, they're kind of not on my radar. Frankly, I forget about them sometimes.
yeah, it's interesting.
I'm
fascinated by your ruling of requiring this massive source, especially in terms of fire, which I feel like has never come up for me in a game, but seems logical the way you explain it. So I'm like kind of curious to see. It feels like a reasonable ruling. I don't know. It's definitely going to make fire elementals even more rare when they're already super rare. So do I want that? I don't know. But I don't hate it.
Yep, cool.
Viewers, if you have opinions on elementals, the right size, the right mechanism for concentration, any other thoughts on like where they came from in literature or myth, how you use them in game? Yeah, have you even seen them in game? Do they show up in your games? Leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe your thoughts will inspire a new topic for us down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites. So please look for us there and conjure that like button.
If you prefer to listen to us in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcast files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also available through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us on one of those sites right now and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, again, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, we'll be there. Every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversations about old and new D&D and everything in between are continuing 24/7. All kinds of interesting stuff that is brought to my attention there. And we'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the chat with our live video after chat with our patrons. We would love to see you there if you're a first-time joiner. Now, Paul, we're actually going to be off next week because I'm going to be personally wandering to Massachusetts for our house con with our friends where we have on the Massachusetts coast there, which I adore. And at this time next week, at the time for our show, I will actually be running Wizards Warzone and probably dealing with the elemental issue at exactly this moment. So unfortunately, I had to say I will not be available for the show next week as a result.
Yep. Yeah. Likewise, I'll be embroiled in a game during that time period as well. So yeah, we're just going to skip it. But I'm sure that convention will inspire a lot of interesting thoughts for us in the following episode.
Definitely. We have some stuff other planned. It's a pretty busy April for us, but we have some other stuff planned in the meantime. So hope you'll join us again in 2 weeks will be the plan. Is what we'll be doing. So we are live most Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll really join us again in 2 weeks for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you.